This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Islamic terrorism and Iran's nuclear program may not be the easiest subjects to crack wise about, but our guest, actor and comedian Maz Jobrani, has spent years getting audiences to laugh at and think about our perceptions and misperceptions of people of Middle Eastern descent in the post-9/11 era. Jobrani was born in Iran but grew up in the United States and was part of the comedy group Axis of Evil, which toured the U.S. and the Middle East, working material drawn from the War on Terror. Jobrani has had several movie and TV roles, including a recurring part on the Fox series 24 and a role as an Indian cab driver in the short-lived ABC series Knights of Prosperity. Here's a bit of a stand-up act from the Axis of Evil comedy tour.
I'm the Iranian. It's funny because people, I tell them, my American friends, I go, yeah, I'm Iranian. They go, oh, so you're Arab. And I'm like, no, we're actually different. We're not Arab. But, you know, I mean, we're similar. You know, we're all getting shot at. You know, that's one thing. But, you know, but Iranians are actually, ethnically, we're actually, you know, we're Aryan. We're white. We're white. So stop shooting. You know, that's what I'm trying to... And then my American friends go, well, how can we tell you apart? How can we? And I go, well, it's in the accent. It's in the accent. Iranians, when Iranians speak, they talk a lot slower. Iranians talk like this. Iranians talk like this. We talk very slow, like, you know, maybe we just shot some heroin. We're falling asleep. How are you? How are you? I am Iranian. How are you? How are you? It's Iranian. Okie dokie, it's Iranian. Take it easy, don't worry about it. I'm Iranian. And Arab talk a lot faster. Arab talk a lot faster. Arab talk like they did some cocaine, they're talking. How are you? Iranian is slow. Iranian, we like, you know, we Iranian don't even say they're Iranian. Iranian say they're Persian. Iranian, we say we are Persian. You know, it sounds nicer and friendlier. We even smile. When we say we're Persian, we smile. I am Persian. I am Persian.
Maz Jobrani is now on a solo stand-up comedy tour. His act, called Maz Jobrani, Brown and Friendly, draws material from his Iranian-American upbringing. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recently spoke to Jobrani after he performed in Philadelphia.
Well, Maz Jobrani, welcome back to Fresh Air. I was lucky enough to catch your stand-up act in Philadelphia at the TLA. One of the great things about the act is there are certain jokes that are really about Iranians in Iranian language and Iranian culture, which you deliver in ways that are still funny to those of us who aren't. But I could see the people around me really falling out and really enjoying this stuff because it hit home. Talk a little bit about some of the cultural and linguistic and physical traits that you have fun with.
Well, you know, there's a lot of cultural things that I've wanted to present to my Western audience about the Iranian culture that they don't know about. For example, there's this word taruf, which it doesn't translate into English. But the best way I describe it is when two Persian men will come to a door and they'll stop and they'll start bowing and putting their hands on their chest and insisting that the other one goes first. And it's all about showing humility, and no matter who you are, you have to belittle yourself and build the other person up. So you're at this door, standing at the door, going, please, please, after you, please. No, no, I know I'm a doctor, but I'm a horrible doctor. You should go first. You know, I have a lot of malpractice suits. Please, you go first. And the key, like I said, it's about painting that picture so that your Western audience can laugh with you. And then, of course, the people of that culture know it so well, so they tend to laugh even harder.
Right. You do a lot with Iranian speech patterns, which I might imagine that some Iranians might not take so well in a different setting, but in that one it really works.
Yeah, I think, again, it's funny. I think I was in college, and I took a class in Farsi, and the teacher pointed this out to us, that we have Iranians, when they are trying to pronounce an English word that has two consonants, we can't do it. We add a vowel. So Steve becomes Esteve. Friend becomes Ferend. Drink becomes Derink. It's fun to play with that. And you know, I always form a sentence, you know, tell Esteve to bring a drink and bring his Ferend and avoid the traffic. You know, and I think, again, the audience laughs. You know, the younger people love it because that's their parents they're hearing, you know. I've done shows in front of, let's say, an older crowd who all speak like that. And then they're looking at me going like, I don't get it. What's so funny? You know, and so you got to pull back a little bit and go, this is you guys, man.
And it's okay for me to laugh, right?
Of course. Of course. That's the whole point. And I, you know, you saw throughout the show, throughout the night, I took several opportunities to stop and kind of remind people that it's a mixed crowd, even though there's a lot of Persians, there was Arabs, there was, you know, there was just white Americans, there was Asians, there was black Americans, Muslims, Jews. And I try and reiterate that so that people know that we're all laughing together. And like you just said, it's okay for us all to laugh because that's what the whole night's about.
And you got special little jabs picked out for Egyptians and people from Dubai and Palestinians and all over.
Yeah, well, that comes from traveling out there. You know, when I was on the tour a couple years ago with the Access to Evil comedy tour, and we performed all those places. And I'll tell you, Dave, it's amazing how every culture wants you to mention them. And I've done so many shows. I'll come off stage, be in the lobby, and some Armenians will come up and go, why didn't you know do any jokes about Armenians? And I go, oh, I didn't know you were in the crowd. You should have yelled something. You need more jokes about Armenians. I'm like, all right, I'll make sure I get some.
If you're just joining us, our guest is comedian Maz Jobrani. He's currently doing a stand-up tour. His act is called Brown and Friendly. You were born in Iran but immigrated to the United States at a very young age, right?
Yeah, I was 6 years old when we came to America. And, you know, I've gone back and looked at some of the news clippings from that time, and nobody really knew that the revolution was going to happen the way it happened.
You know, what year was this, and why did your parents leave?
This was late 78.
Right.
My father was in New York on business. The schools were closing early because of the protests in the streets of Iran. And I remember there'd be a curfew. You know, the lights would be out. Once in a while, we would hear gunfire and the sort in the streets, and we'd have to go down to the basement with my mom and the rest of the family. So my father was in New York on business, and he said, well, if the schools are out early, he said to my mom, why don't you get Maz and my sister, Miriam, why don't you guys come out for 2 weeks during that school break, and then you can go back. And just to show you that we really didn't intend to stay that long, we left my baby brother back in Iran. My brother was, I think, about a year old, and we literally thought we'd be gone for 2 weeks. And I always say we packed for 2 weeks, we came for 2 weeks, but we stayed for 30 years. You know, things just got worse and worse while we were out here.
So that was the revolution that overthrew the Shah of Iran back then.
Yeah, exactly.
What became of your baby brother?
He's now the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And I email him from time to time. Hey, bro, what's going on, dude? No, we got him out, you know, like a year later. You know, a lot of the family came out slowly but surely. And we all ended up settling in Marin County and growing up over there. And it was, you know, it was an interesting transition because you knew you were a foreign kid, and you just wanted to be one of the guys. But all it took was, you know, bringing one of the guys over to your house and the smells of the food and the accents of the parents and all this other stuff. You just wanted to, like, lock up your family in their bedroom and just say, you know, please wait till my friends leave so that they don't realize that I'm not from this country.
Right. I mean, every kid's embarrassed by their parents in some way. And right, when you're trying to fit in, it's hard. Now, in your act, you talk about how Iranian parents expect their kids to pursue higher education. They always want them to be doctors or lawyers. Did your parents have the same expectation of you?
Absolutely. I actually, I did theater in high school, and I wanted to go study theater in college. And I remember talking to my parents about that, and I told my mom and dad, you know, I want to be an actor. And my mom said, well, you know, you should first be a lawyer, and then you can do acting on the weekends. And besides, she said, you know, lawyers act all the time. You get to stand in front of, you know, 12 people. That's an audience. You know, if you count the judge, that's 13 people. And so that's an audience, you know. So they basically convinced me to actually go and study political science. As an undergrad major.
Right. And you actually got into a doctoral program but just couldn't stick with it, right?
Yeah. You know what happened was I was studying poli-sci as undergrad at Cal, my junior year, I went to Italy and studied there for a year. And I came back wanting to be a professor because I had this professor in Italy that was great. His name was Enzo Pace. And he would come into class every day. He taught a class on the sociology of Islam. And he would come in. He had this little gold pocket watch. And he would take the pocket watch out in the beginning of the class. And he'd flip it open. And he'd take a look at it. And he'd flip it closed. And then he'd look up at the class. And he'd go, ah, allora, momento. Which would mean, okay, let's talk about Muhammad. You know, and it's just like this really cool guy. And I was like, I want to be that guy. So I came back to America and got into a PhD program at UCLA for poli-sci. And I ended up dropping out of grad school, doing acting as a hobby and working in advertising. The idea was to my mom and my grandmother at the time, because my father had gone back to Iran and I was the oldest son of the household. The idea was that, hey, I have an office job. I get up in the morning, I put on a tie, and I go to this office. Now, you know, granted, I was the, you know, assistant, you know, and it was a, you know, I was a secretary basically, but I was going to an office, so it kind of made my mom happy. And then what was interesting was as she started to realize that this was just some job I was doing to just have a day job, then she and my grandmother would sit me down and they would say, listen, this is not going anywhere. And this acting, we don't know. So you need a job that people need you. You need a job where people need you because you never know, a revolution might happen. Now, these are people that came from a revolution. That you need to have a job where you can do it anywhere in the world. So we recommend you go and learn to be a mechanic because people have cars and they always need to be fixed. And I was like, I don't want to be a mechanic. You should be a mechanic. And then I said, no. And then they would say, okay, how about a washing machine fixer guy? People have washing machines. And they just go down this list of these crazy jobs for me to do. Because they were they thought that, you know, they had no idea where this was going with the acting stuff.
Yeah, at least it's an income.
Yeah.
When you did get into acting, did you, you know, you want to get work. Did you get offered roles like the Middle Eastern terrorist? And how did you feel about taking that kind of stuff?
Oh, Dave, you don't know. One of the first roles I got was to play a security guard on Chicago Hope. It was a guest star on Chicago Hope. Regular guy, no accent, just a regular guy. And I'm thinking, this is great. This is exactly what I thought it was going to be. Well, one of the next parts I get is an Afghan terrorist who's trying to come up with a bomb to blow up a building in Chicago in a Chuck Norris movie of the week. And I go, wait a minute, this is not the route I wanted to go. And I remember actually taking that part. It was interesting because, you know, in your mind, you're going, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to bring some amazing acting to it. And I thought, you know, as an actor, what you do is when you get a part, even if it's not on the page, you write, you know, the biography of the character, of how he got to where he is. And you think that through my acting, I will be able to show the audience why my character is doing what he's doing. So I wrote this whole background about, you know, this guy was in Afghanistan and his family died at the hands of some bombs that were provided by the Americans, and this is his revenge. And, you know,
you're going to reveal the humanity to the audience, right? Yeah.
Going to reveal the humanity, Dave. That's what I'm doing here through my amazing acting ability in a Chuck Norris movie.
and you get on the set and...
Yeah, it's exactly. So fly down to Dallas to film, go to the wardrobe fitting, show up at wardrobe, and this is supposed to be an Afghan man in America who's trying to lay low in Chicago. So I show up, and they go, here's your shirt, here's your pants, here's your turban. And I go, just so you know, Afghan Muslims in America don't wear turbans. I said, that's just not what they do. I said, you know, I know a lot of Middle Eastern Muslims. I know a lot of Afghans that were at UC Berkeley that, you know, they might, if they're serious, they might, you know, button up the shirt all the way to the top. You know, they might have a little bit of a beard going, but they're not going to be wearing a turban. I said, especially if the guy's trying to lay low in the middle of Chicago. And basically the gist of the response was, listen, dude, this is a Chuck Norris movie. You know, put on the turban and shut up. And don't forget your basket and your snake. Get the hell out of here. You know. So that was my experience with that, and it kind of left a bad taste in my mouth.
Were you able to stop doing that stuff, or did you feel like you needed to?
Well, I came back to L.A. and I told my agents. I said, you know, guys, no more. I don't want to do this anymore. And they said, all right. And then, like, I don't know how long went by, maybe 6 months to a year or something, and suddenly get a call from the TV show 24. And they say, we have a part. We don't want you to audition for it, but we can't tell you if he's a good guy or a bad guy. And I said, well, what is he? You know, and they said, well, he's an Iranian guy, and, you know, it might turn out that he's a good guy. And I go, all right, I'll come audition. So I auditioned for it. They didn't give me that part, but they came back a few weeks later, and they said, there is a terrorist. I said, no. And then they said, but he ends up changing his mind during the mission. And I go, that's kind of interesting. And ever since then, I've referred to him as the ambivalent terrorist. So it was in season two, and I'm driving this truck, and there's these two other terrorists in the truck with me, and we have a bomb in the back. And halfway through the mission, I look out the window, and I see some kids playing. So I have a change of heart, and I basically, you know, turn to the other guys, and I go, hey, guys, do we really have to kill people? And then they take out a gun, and they shoot me. And I'm going, all right, well, that's not kind of how I planned this to happen. So that was my last time I played a terrorist part. And I told my agents after that, I said, no more of this stuff. You know, it's just you see so much of it in film and television. And it's such an unfortunate thing that it's so instilled in people's minds. I have a friend of mine who told me, an American Jewish friend who told me he traveled to Iran just to go, you know, check it out. This was like a couple years ago. And he said when he decided to go, his parents were freaking out, saying, you're going to get kidnapped. You know, this is dangerous. And he said it couldn't have been further from the truth. You know, he told me a story about being at a train station an Iranian man seeing that he's, you know, a Western-looking kid, and he didn't have a jacket. It was cold. And the Iranian man goes, you know, are you from, you know, America? And the guy says, yeah. And he goes, please, take my jacket. And he says, what? And he goes, no, it's cold. You're a guest in our country. Take my jacket. And so that's really the reality of you know, a lot of people there. You know, when you get through the politics and everything, that's what the people are.
I've heard that you're working on a film, Timmy Vestfood. Is this true?
Jimmy Vestfood.
Jimmy Vestfood.
Yeah, Jimmy Vestfood is a film that a friend of mine, Amir Ohebsian, and I wrote. It's basically, the way we describe it is like a Persian Pink Panther kind of meets Bennett like Beckham. It's about this Iranian guy living in Westwood with his mother in a little apartment, and he's working at a rug store. And all his life he's wanted to be an American hero, because back in the old country he used to watch Steve McQueen films. And this is actually true that, you know, back in the 70s, Steve McQueen was huge. I mean, Iranians loved Steve McQueen, and we named him Steve McQueen. So you got to pronounce it right. So this guy's a big Steve McQueen fan, and he's always wanted to be this cool guy, you know, saving the day. But he's working at a rug store, and then he ends up in this situation where he's delivering a rug, and there's this blonde femme fatale who basically seduces him and hires him on as a private investigator to follow her husband, who she says is cheating on him. Little does he know that he's being used as a witness to a fake crime. So it's kind of like it's kind of like Pink Panther meets Alfred Hitchcock in a way. It goes to what I've been talking about, which is my goal is to have this Middle Eastern hero in American cinema, so that you have 12-year-old kids, you know, quoting Jimmy Vestfood, you know, saying, you know, I will gonna take care of it, which is how he says, I'm gonna take care of it. He says, I will gonna take care of it. And the tagline for the film is, you don't have to be American to be an American hero. So we're trying to get that made.
All right, we'll look forward to it. Before we let you go, I wanted to talk a little bit more about stand-up. You started stand-up, and it was rough at first. It always is. And I'm always fascinated at watching someone who has developed a polished act. I mean, your set now is more than an hour, and it really moves. And as you developed the craft, was there a point that you understood, I'm getting this? I mean, what made the difference between, you know, bombing and starting to feel like you had the audience?
You know, I always give a lot of credit to the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. It's owned by Mitzi Shore, who's Pauly Shore's mother, and she's created this kind of Gold's Gym of comedy. And it was this original, and the way it's set up is it's this dark room where the lights are blinding you and you don't see the audience. So you don't really have to worry about, am I bombing, am I not bombing? You just kind of say what you want to say. And when she first made me a regular, she saw me do a few sets, and she didn't have any Middle Eastern comedians at the club at the time. So she finally was going to make me a regular, and it's kind of like, you know, Yoda or Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of taking you aside. And she says, you know, she's kind of talks like this, and she says, why don't you wear the outfit? And I go, what outfit? She goes, you know, the hat and the gown. And she wanted me to do the turban and the whole thing as part of my act. and I said, oh, okay, sure. And then I left thinking, okay, she's going to forget about it because, you know, this is a Sunday night. By the time I call in on Monday to, you know, get the official agreement from the booker, they will have forgotten about it. Well, I got a call Monday from the booker saying, congratulations, you're in. And Mitzi said you're going to wear the outfit. And I go, ugh. I started cringing, and I said, listen, I got to tell you, I really don't want to wear the outfit. And she says, well, you know, Mitzi has helped create all these other great comedians, and you should wear the outfit. Well, it became this dilemma of, do I wear the outfit? Do I not wear the outfit? And I discussed it with my family, and the one saving grace that got me out of wearing the outfit was my father was living in Iran at the time, and there had been a story of this Iranian impersonator in Los Angeles who would do stuff in the Iranian market, like Iranian clubs and the sort. And this guy would impersonate the mullahs at these, you know, at these events. And one time when he was impersonating a mullah, someone who was a supporter of the regime threw a rock and blinded one eye of the guy. And so I brought that story to their attention, and I said, listen, my dad's living in Iran, and if somehow the word gets out that there's this guy coming to your club and doing this mullah stuff, you know, he could be in danger, we could be in danger. And so at that point they said, all right, fine, don't wear the outfit. Don't worry about the outfit. We don't want any danger. And the funny thing about it was a few years later after we started, you know, making progress in that club, I saw Mitzi again, and, you know, she's getting a little older. And I thought she's totally forgotten about that day. And she kind of pulled me aside. She goes, you were supposed to wear the outfit. you got me there.
One more thing. You know, you've been doing this Middle Eastern humor for a long time. And, of course, since 9/11. And I'm wondering whether you can see changes in the audience depending upon what level of tension and terror there is in the world and whether it affects what you can do and what you can't, or what people will laugh at and what they won't.
Absolutely. I think that comedians actually, we kind of take the pulse of the country a lot. I remember leading up to the Iraq War, I was doing a lot of jokes about George Bush and people were laughing. Then on the eve of the war, there was that line that had been put out there, if you don't support the war, you don't support the troops. That line had been sold to the public. And I remember doing a joke about George Bush and the sort. And I remember in Los Angeles, where you would think that the crowds would still go with you, that it was a very lukewarm response. It was literally like from one day to the next. It went from huge laughter to lukewarm. And I realized, oh, my God, this audience is uncomfortable about laughing here because they feel if they laugh, they're not supporting the troops. And so I had to do an extra joke in there that would allow them to laugh. And I said, listen, when I'm doing this material, you know, I'm not trying to criticize the troops. I said, you know, I'm pretty sure no one ever goes, you know what, I love the administration. It's those damn troops that are pissing me off. You know, you never hear that.
Right.
So I had to kind of let them know that it's okay to laugh at these jokes because we're making fun of the president here. We're not making fun of the troops. And so, yeah, you're always taking the pulse of an audience and seeing what you can and can't laugh about. I mean, just recently with the Israeli-Palestinian thing that went on, you know, I stayed away from it for a while because there's really no comedy there. But, you know, as you saw in the show, what I tend to do now is at some point, if someone, you know, as I'm going around and talking about different groups, if someone says, I'm Palestinian, I'll say, all right, give it up for Palestine. I'll do a joke about, you know, them being Palestinian and me being Iranian and how I'm going to, you know, sell them some arms at the end of the show. But then the next question I ask is, who's Jewish in the crowd? And, you know, inevitably somebody will raise their hand. And in the past, I've had it where I said, you know, okay, guys, get up. You're hugging each other right now. And they've gotten up and hugged. And you know, and sometimes I'll say, you know, wave at each other or whatever. And it's just kind of this reinforcement that, you know, even though the world is crazy and people are fighting and there's these wars, that in this room together, we can laugh together.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to what you come up with next. Maz Jobrani, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Maz Jobrani is currently on a solo comedy tour, which continues in Sacramento, Houston, Tempe, Arizona, Washington, D.C., and Irvine, California. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who's a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.